Okay, I am here with Professor Apurvanand, teaches Hindi at Delhi University and frequent writer at, you know, in my opinion, one of the best sites if you want to follow events in India, which is The Wire, thewire.in, a great resource, one of the only, you know, oppositional journalism outlets left, I think. There are others, but it's definitely up there. Apurvanand, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin.
So we were on a panel, last week or a little bit before. It was at the India EU summit, and we were both talking about the right wing, like the far right, and the way it organizes the international aspects of it. And I was struck by your I wanted to invite you to come to talk about all of these things more, because I was really struck by the anatomy of this right wing takeover in India, and the sophistication, the pervasiveness of it. And I kind of see some of these trends happening elsewhere, like including here in Canada. There's groups called the Proud Boys and their links with Steve Bannon and the links with the Conservative Party and you know, attacks on universities. But everything that's happening here, it seems to me, is much more advanced in India. So I wanted to just talk to you about how this right wing rise has developed and what's happening now, so that everybody can understand how the right wing works now, because I think it is quite different than a lot of people think it is.
Yes, thank you very much, Justin. And was very much persuaded by the way you had formulated the nature of right wing in Brazil and also in India. And I think that applied to India as well, because the right wing in India or in Brazil, now they're not as audacious as Hitler was. So Hitler did try to overstep himself, and that is how he committed suicide in a way.
Yeah. The overstep being challenging the British and American empires, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I think that had Hitler been wiser, like his Indian descendants, yeah, Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, he would not have stepped out of Germany. And then he would have lasted longer, much longer. Mm-hmm. Because the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, organization, I call it ecosystem, and its political wing, Bharatiya Janata Party, don't commit this mistake or blunder. Mm-hmm. So they know their place in geopolitics of the present world, and they don't like to challenge the supremacy of the United States of America.
Right.
They will do a shadow boxing with China. But they and their followers also know that it is foolish and idiotic even to challenge China. And that is why when China made an intrusion in Indian territory last year, there was not a word from the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, not a word of bravado from the government. They kept mum. So this very thing that you know your place in geopolitical structure of the world and what you want to do within your territory is to tell other groups you have othered to know their place.
Yeah.
So that is how it works.
The example that I give of Brazil was that, you know, Bolsonaro, during his campaign, would salute an American flag. And when he's marching, he marches under an Israeli flag. So you would usually think, when you think of Nazis or fascists in Italy, that they're hyper-patriotic. But today's fascists all kneel before the U.S. as part of their, you know, part of their fascism. So they're not about being number one in the world. They acknowledge that the US is number one in the world.
Yes. And in a way, it's not equivalent to what the Brazilian chief was doing. Mm-hmm. But the Prime Minister of India campaigning for the President of the United States of America, before the Indian diaspora in the US, it could have been deemed very humiliating for Indians.
Yeah.
And Trump was invited to India, and a program to campaign for Trump was organized in Gujarat, state of Bihar, which Narendra Modi belongs to. So that is how it is working. So the Brazilian chief saluting American flag, and Indian chief campaigning for American president. It's quite unheard of, but this is, and it was applauded by the followers of Narendra Modi and members of Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, and it didn't at all hurt their nationalist pride, I would say.
So another thing that I find about the right wing that people get wrong is the idea of like that the right wing has these legitimate grievances that have to be addressed one way or another. And what you know, when you look at their grievances, a lot of them are not legitimate. A lot of them are not even fact-based, but like some sense of imagined humiliation for some, you know, a lot of made-up history goes into it. A lot of, you know, things that happened 1,000 years ago, according to one story, and not another. And so, you know, it's a mistake to like the grievances could be legitimate or they could not. That's not really the issue. The issue is, that the right wing is kind of a reactionary force against any kind of social progress, whether it's, you know, in North America, there's a lot of opposition to trans rights or to LGBT rights right now, or Black Lives Matter. In India, I imagine, you know, it's the assertion of women's rights or, you know, Muslims, Kashmir. So there are different issues, but it's not, you know, the legitimacy of the grievances doesn't really have much to do with their ability to campaign. How does that play out in
the Yes. Many of our liberal friends entertain this idea that they have some legitimate grievances. For example, in academia, generally people say that they were ignored and they were pushed in a corner, the right-wing intellectuals. But when you ask who these right-wing intellectuals are and who these right-wing academics are, there are no names. For example, again, this idea that Indian thought system or Indian thought was ignored, it was not privileged, and Western thought system was privileged over Indian thought system. So what exactly was Indian thought system? And who has written extensively about it? Has any right-wing intellectual, quote unquote, has any right-wing intellectual tried to enlighten us about what the past is according to them? But you won't find a good Sanskrit scholar in the whole right-wing ecosystem. You won't find a good archaeologist there. You won't find a good or sound authority on the Dharmashastras. There's none.
Right.
So who had prevented them from working on these things? And the scholars we call left-wing have worked on in these areas, for example, on Dharmashastra, for example, on Vedas, for example, in the field of archaeology. They have worked very hard. So to to say that they have some genuine grievances and they should be given their due in academia, in universities, I think it's false. It's all false.
The university question, I think, is a huge one, because that's there's a very similar argument in North America. The idea is that there's a liberal bias in North American universities. There's this terrible woke culture, it's called, you know, cancel culture, left-leaning professors indoctrinating students. And then, you know, again, like you look at the curriculum or you look at the departments. I mean, every economics department in every university, and they all have them, is teaching neoclassical, you know, economics. They're not out there teaching Marx's volumes 1 to 3, right? Like, there's almost no left political economy in hardly any university. So there's, you know, the idea that there's a liberal bias comes by, you know, ignoring, you know, huge fields that are well supported, and then saying, okay, well, in sociology you might find a leftist here, or in, you know, criminology you might find, well, criminology is actually pretty right wing too, but you know, certain specific departments you might find some left wingers, therefore there's a big left wing bias. And they try to claim you know, affirmative action or positive discrimination to say, you know, we should have more conservatives in the academy to balance this out. So the way they use balance, you know, is also, they're happy to try to use balance to get themselves in a majority, and then all talk of balance will then stop, because they have no interest in balancing their views with left-wing views.
Yes.
So, but yeah, tell me about. Tell me about the university takeover specifically in India.
So I'll share an interesting anecdote with you. So I started getting calls from World Brahmin Council 5 or 6 years back. So I was getting calls and emails from this World Brahmin Council.
Oh, yeah.
You know what Brahmin is.
Of course, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Well, for listeners, India has a caste system, which is, you know, I don't know how to introduce a caste system, but there's a hierarchy of people. You're born into this a certain level in the hierarchy, and at the top of the hierarchy are the Brahmins. So the Brahmin is the upper caste. You might have heard the term Dalit or untouchable. That's the lowest caste, and in between there are other castes. But the leadership of the current BJP, if you look at it, is actually Brahmin. But that's, unfortunately, that's probably true of all political parties, isn't it, Apurvanand?
Yes.
Some disproportion. It's
getting much more complex and complicated nowadays, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah.
Because how this whole Brahminical ideology is working, but it's working through people who belong to the other backward caste, or who belong to even Dalit castes, I would say, many of the scheduled castes. So I started getting calls from World Brahmin Council. And so this person who is coordinating this council calls me and says that we are going to have a run for Vedas. Huh. And this, the month was December, and he was proposing 2nd January or 6th January, I don't exactly remember, that we should have a run for Vedas. So I asked him, why are you running for Vedas? So what has happened to Vedas? He said that, there's a lot of misconception about Vedas, and we need to create awareness about Vedas. And then I asked him, that who is creating misconception about Vedas?
Sorry, I should also pause and say, for listeners, the Vedas we're talking about are the holy scriptures of Hinduism, the equivalent of like the Bible. So it would be like having a run for the Bible. So it would be like the World Bible Council contacting a professor and saying, we want to have a run for the Bible. So go on. Sorry.
So I asked him that who is creating misconception about Vedas? And he said Romila Thapar,
the basically historian. The the dean of Indian ancient history, right? Medieval ancient.
Yes. Medieval history. And then I asked him that Romila Thapar is not the education minister of India. She is not prime minister. She doesn't even head the University Grant Commission, that is the apex body which looks after higher education in India. She is not even a vice chancellor of any university. She writes books. So so how is it that she is so powerful that she has created misconceptions about Vedas and you want to clear it and create awareness by running for Vedas? And then I suggested it to him that, look, what you need to do is not to run for Vedas, but sit for Vedas.
Yeah, so sit and read something.
Please sit and read. And I remember another discussion which I was having on a TV channel with a representative of the student wing of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. And I asked him that if you are so aggrieved by what Wendy Doniger has written, and you know the controversy that Wendy Doniger's book had created in India, and the right wingers had forced the publishers to pulp the book of Wendy Doniger.
Yeah.
So I asked him that if you feel aggrieved, why don't you write a response, a scholarly response to Wendy Doniger? And prompt came the reply that it takes time. It takes time. So
but I running, asked him. But run, you, anybody can just get up and run, right?
So to sit and do some scholarly work and to sit and write a scholarly response to Wendy Doniger takes time and energy. So why not burn the book? Or why not force the publisher to pulp the book by attacking the showrooms of the publisher? So that is how the right wing works. And we start believing that they have some certain genuine grievances we must address. I think it's false, it's phony, as you rightly say.
Yeah. Wendy Doniger, by the way, the book that caused this whole kerfuffle is The Hindus and Alternative History. And Wendy Doniger is a kind of a South Asianist, I guess, an Indologist, a professor at the University of Chicago. So, so, you know, there's the relationship to scholarship and there's the relationship to science. Another one of these elements of right-wing politics today is that, you know, they'll use the technology in the sense of, WhatsApp, right? Or Facebook, like they'll use the tech, but again, in India, for example, the whole tech ecosystem is basically US based and US run. So there's no concept of like, maybe we should have sovereignty over our communications technology. So that's, you know, that's not a thing that the right wing is interested in. But it's also whenever anything to do with science or inquiry or education or knowledge conflicts with their political agendas, they're happy to discard it. And I think, you know, the COVID situation is an example of that too, right? So like, are things getting at all, but is there any light at the end of the tunnel as far as COVID goes in Delhi, or is it just getting worse and worse?
For last two days, the reports that are coming in tell us about the possibility of Delhi numbers reaching the plateau.
Okay.
But we are not still very sure.
Yeah.
And we'll have to watch for one or two more to be sure about the story of numbers plateauing. Right. But as an expert were told the Indian Express, it was published by the Indian Express today itself. And he says that even if we reach that plateau, it would be a very high point. Yeah. So if we start descending from that point, even if we assume that we are plateauing, So that descent would take a very, very long time. So it's going to take a very long time. And Delhi is suffering, and I think the suffering is going to last in this acute form for at least 15 days,
wow,
2 weeks. That is how we see it. It's very painful.
And there is an anti-science thing going on with all of this, right? I mean,
yes, because, you know, even scientists are not very sure about how to describe this virus and how to explain the way it is spreading. Mm-hmm. And Indian scientists have done, especially the official scientists, I would say, not that there are not credible voices in the field of science. They are there, but they are not in the system, mm-hmm, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So the people who are in system, they have played a very opportunist role, I would say. For example, the apex body, ICMR, Indian Council of Medical Research, which is the apex body, and you would look up to ICMR for guidance and for understanding the pandemic, the nature of it, and how it is progressing, and how you deal with it. But if you look at how ICMR is working, it has not helped the people of India in any manner to understand the virus, understand the pandemic. And they have been very opaque, and what they have done, contrary to, for example, the way Dr. Fauci in the United States of America, he performed his professional duty by differing with Donald Trump openly.
Right.
So people of America knew what was there before them. But since the scientists and Indian system have refrained from telling truth to the Indian people, others, for example, the health minister of India, he publicly endorsed a drug developed by a so-called Ayurved entrepreneur, Ramdev, which was not examined or validated by the scientific community. But the health minister shared dais with this person and praised this drug. So an anti-science approach is being propagated by the government itself.
Right.
And so the people believe that there is something in it. And that's why this anti, for example, recently, one of the state governments said that they are going to open a COVID center, and their patients would be treated with cow products.
Right.
Cow dung, cow urine.
Yeah, which
et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so there's no, and now, there's absolutely no scientific evidence that any of that.
No scientific evidence, but this is a state government doing. Now, when warnings about the second wave were being given, alarm bells were being rung. The chief minister of Uttarakhand gave a full page, front page advertisements inviting people to Kumbh, which is a mega festival, inviting lakhs of Hindus to Kumbh and claiming that the holy waters of Ganga would take care of coronavirus. So they need not fear, and lakhs of people congregated.
They think it may have been 3 million people or something that went to the river.
And so, yesterday, the High Court of Uttarakhand chided and scolded the government of Uttarakhand and the center, and said that what they have done is criminal.
Yeah. That may have been the biggest super spreader event in COVID history, probably.
Yes, and this is a chief minister of a state openly inviting people and the prime minister of India welcoming them on the opening day of the festival, welcoming day, tweeting that he welcomes the devotees. So this is chief minister and this is the prime minister of India.
So there's this real negative, you know, I mean, that's an overused word, but negativity in terms of the way that right-wing governments govern. So, you know, if you look at since 2014, what the government has done in India, they've gone after one constituency after another, right? It was like demonetization, which was supposedly against the Maoists, but like was a massive economically devastating policy announced overnight. There was the Citizenship Amendment Act going after the Muslim community. There's the Kashmiri reading down of the constitutional articles. Then there's the Punjabi farmers, the, you know, the agricultural reorganization that the farmers had been protesting against before this new wave of COVID. So like the way of ruling also has to do with like isolating constituencies and targeting them for like almost it's a little bit like an electoral campaign, even though they're already in power. So like, what, you know, can you tell me what your sense is of this dynamic of like perpetually campaigning against some or other group?
Observing the way they are functioning, it's not actually governance. What they are doing, they are disrupting the system.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's in a way a counter-revolution being staged. Yeah. And the system is what they call 70 years. So the 70 years is a metaphor for the system. And they are telling their constituents, and the constituents are largely Hindus, and they entertain some grievances against those who denied them power after 47, because they thought that India should have been legitimately a Hindu Rashtra, and it was denied that. So 70 years merged with quote-unquote 800 years or 1,000 years of, again, so-called Muslim rule. And what Narendra Modi and Bharatiya Janata Party under his leadership is doing is staging a counter-revolution. Mm-hmm. And to use the terminology that Mao had used, that it has to be permanent revolution. So it cannot stop. Mm-hmm. You have to keep disrupting. And the disruptions have to be huge, because you have to tell the electorate, your constituents, that I am convinced that it needed to be done. It needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing it. So the constituents are in awe of their leader, that he can take such a huge decision, and he is so decisive. He is not afraid of disrupting the very basis of economy, and he is taking away cash from us. So he did it very boldly, and so I say that this government under Narendra Modi is working through disruption. It keeps disrupting, and one of the results of disruption, constant disruptions, is that it throws your mind, it creates a lot of confusion in the minds of the people. Mm-hmm. Their minds remain eternally agitated and eternally confused. So the only response they try to hold on to is the response that the government is giving, because others are speaking in different voices.
Yeah.
For example, there would be some economists who will try to understand sincerely why demonetization was done. And there would be fierce critiques. So people are confused. So they would like to hold on to the explanation that their leader is giving to them. And so it's a series of disruptions. He's constantly disrupting. He's disrupting the social life. He's disrupting the cultural life. He's disrupting economic life. And he's telling them that, look, I'm convinced. I'm doing it for your good. And so you, since you elected me, you have given me the right to do it. And so this constant agitation, constant confusion.
And then infiltration, right? I mean, one of the striking things you talked about on the panel was the case of Jawaharlal Nehru University, JNU, which I guess is not the biggest university, but it probably has a reputation as being one of these left-wing bastions. So does, you know, Jamia Millia Islamia was also like attacked, almost like a military attack, where they attacked buildings and students and tear gassed the library and everything, just, I guess, last year, right? But you were saying that they installed a new, can you just talk about how they got the takeover of JNU, I guess?
See, they suffer from what I call JNU complex, because they see JNU as a fortress they have to annex. Uh-huh. And it's a fortress, as you said, described it, left-wing citadel. So they have to demolish it. And only by demolishing it would they be able to establish their intellectual supremacy. So that is their dream. Even if you travel to the villages of Bihar, a friend of mine was telling me that he was talking to his co-villagers, and one of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh workers told him that we will demolish your JNU. Now, this is the man who has nothing to do with JNU. He had not studied there. He doesn't know anything about JNU, but he has this in his heart that JNU needs to be demolished.
So that exists in North America too. You'll hear people who, you know, they hate what's going on campuses. You know, you can't speak your mind on campuses. And it's like, you haven't.
Yes. So in a way, I say that campuses act as liberated zones, because people come from the close communities to campuses, and here they experiment with new ideas. Here they develop new friendships. Here they get in touch with people they would never get to see in their communities, because India is divided into many castes, and they live horizontally together.
But so you're saying in some ways, the right wing is right to be afraid of universities.
Yes. So I call universities liberated zones, because people, when they come from society to universities, they feel liberated. Mm-hmm. And that is why universities and these liberated zones need to be colonized again by the right-wing people. And that is why they targeted JNU first. But before JNU, the Hyderabad Central University was targeted. Mm-hmm. We must not forget that. Okay. That was before Jawaharlal Nehru University, and that was 2015. Wow. And even before that, if you recall, because you are observing what is happening in India, that a small study circle in the IIT Chennai, IIT Madras, Tamil Nadu, and this was a study circle which is called Periyar Ambedkar Study Circle. Periyar is a known social reformer of Tamil Nadu, and Ambedkar, you know, he is regarded as the giver of Constitution of India and the tallest leaders of Dalits. Yeah. So this study circle was banned. And after that, a student organization, a student union, very powerful student union on the campus of Hyderabad Central University, which is known as Ambedkar Student Association. And that was attacked. That was a Dalit, that was a student organization led by Dalits, scheduled caste people. And the allegation was that they are not real, genuine Dalits. They are pseudo Dalits, and they are actually Maoists working in the garb of Dalits. So before JNU, Hyderabad Central University was attacked, and the ministers of central government got involved in the affairs of Hyderabad Central University. They wrote petitions, central government ministers writing petitions against a student organization at the campus to the vice chancellor. And the vice chancellor, on the basis of those petitions, penalizing those students. It happened before the attack on Jawaharlal Nehru University.
It's like a little lab experiment, I guess, before the...
Yes. So it's a series of events. It's a series of attacks. And in JNU, they could achieve that because they also managed to appoint their man as the vice chancellor of Jawaharlal Nehru University. And the best way to destroy any university is by appointing faculty members who would then ensure that the university doesn't remain what it was. Right. So the vice chancellor has managed to appoint more than, I'm told, 250 faculty members at different levels who are very close.
The faculty is not that big. It's like 600-700, I think, total, isn't it?
But I don't know the exact strength of the faculty, but it's not more than, I would say, 900.
Yeah.
So it's a small base.
Proportion.
So if you manage to appoint 300, then it's huge.
Yeah, that's all you need. A 300 out of 900 can stop anything from happening. They can stop the whole thing from work. They can shut the whole place down if they want, basically.
Yes, and they have superseded, for example, an assistant professor can be made a dean.
Right.
So they have destroyed all systems in Jawaharlal Nehru University, and the old systems and conventions of deliberation, because JNU was a deliberative space. And the academic council meetings and the executive council meetings were very deliberative. But the new vice chancellor, who is now the outgoing because his term has completed his term and is on extension. So he saw to it that all systems were disrupted and destroyed. Right. So in a way, they have demolished JNU, and it would be very difficult to recover it.
Wow. So those are interesting tactics. Here in Ontario, they just basically closed one of the universities down, citing budget considerations. There's this university called Laurentian in Northern Ontario. So it's kind of serves a smaller community called Sudbury. And they it's a public university, but they used a law for protecting creditors, like a creditor protection law to basically cancel the collective agreement, fire more than half the faculty, close half the programs. So that's another interest, the kind of austerity argument. But that doesn't seem to be a big part of what Modi is doing, is it? Like the idea that...
No. They have a different method to achieve their hegemony because they don't want to close down any campus. What they do, and in India it works very well because the culture of Indian, of the campuses of Indian universities is that of submission. Mm-hmm. So if you appoint a vice chancellor which would toe your line, then the vice chancellor can ensure that nothing happens on the campus which is contrary to the wishes of the regime.
Right.
For example, in Delhi University, and the vice chancellor was not exactly their man.
Yeah.
But what they achieved in Delhi University, and Delhi University is very huge. It has affiliating character. It has many colleges. But what the right wing managed to achieve was that colleges started declining invitation to people who who were known to be critics of this government. So seminars, open seminars, symposia, lectures, they simply stopped.
So there are two other elements that I think we should talk about. One is the way the media has worked, because I see the media in India. I mean, obviously here in the US, anywhere, Brazil, anywhere where these right wings are on the rise, as being so important in the whole process. And India's definitely not an exception to that. So I want to ask you about the media, but then, and after that, I want to talk to you about the opposition and how opposition parties have actually in politics regionally and in the center have potentially helped the rise of the BJP through either bad strategy or being kind of soft on their program. But let's start with the media. How do you understand the role of the media here in this whole ecosystem?
There are two parts to the response to this question. One is that we have to look at the ownership pattern of the media. So now, the major portion of media is owned by Ambani.
Ambani being the greatest billionaire in the country.
And one of the closest friends of Narendra Modi and this regime. So, and Adani has also started showing interest in the media, but Ambani has great influence in the media. So one is ownership pattern. Second is also, as we discovered in the last decades of 20th century, when the BJP was rising through its campaign on to demolish Babri Masjid, Babri Mosque, right. Was called Ram Janmabhoomi Abhiyan. And if you look at how the language media, that is Hindi media generally, reacted or responded to this movement, you would find that Hindi media was largely aligned with the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. So it became a mouth organ of Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. And that was when Bharatiya Janata Party was not in power.
Right.
So I would say that ideologically, major part of Hindi media is aligned with the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. So it didn't require pressure. We said, we generally say that they are sold out. So sold out, again, is something else, but they're ideologically aligned with this regime. And since our corporate world is also ideologically aligned with this world, regime. So I won't say that they are doing it only to capture power with the help to capture market with the help of the government, and the government is offering everything to its capitalist friends. That can be right, but I would also say that our capitalists are ideologically aligned with this government. So it's not for the sake of profit, business, but it's also ideology which is working behind it. So you have to read the statement of Mohan the Spy, the man behind Infosys. Sometimes this man who heads his company in Bangalore. So their statements are very much in line with the RSS things. So one is that. And later we discovered that not only in Hindi media, but even in English media, in television, you had people who were like sleeping cells of Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh.
Right.
And when Narendra Modi came to power, they suddenly became very active.
Wow.
So The media.
That's partly because they have or a whole like grassroots organizations, kids, you know, exercise and like they've got everything in civil society covered, right? So they're kind of raising children into this ideology too.
So that's why when we were discussing it in our panel, if you recall, I had talked about the way Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh works.
Yeah.
And it's not an organization, it's an ecosystem. Yeah. It has hundreds of organizations, some of them directly under its control, but many of them semi-autonomous and many of them autonomous. Yeah. But they know that they would be protected by the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh if there is any challenge to them. So there are chains of educational institutions, and they also have different trusts, and it works in a very, very clever way. For example, if I ask you, what is the mouth organ or mouthpiece of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh? Since you know India, you know Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, you would automatically say organizer or Panjanya. These are the mouth organs or mouthpieces. Mouthpiece of Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh.
Yeah.
But if you ask Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, they will say, no. They are published by an autonomous trust.
Right.
So we don't own them. So that is how it works. And it has worked like this for last 75 years.
There's something like that in the US, in the sense there's these billionaires that fund these trusts and think tanks. And schools and very religious networks and churches.
So this morning I got news that the chief of Twitter has contributed 2.5 million or billion to a wing of Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is Seva International. Now Seva International works in the name of service.
Yes. So he did it for COVID relief, probably without
COVID relief. But it is actually funding hate.
Yeah.
Because every single penny that you are giving to these organizations, it goes to spreading hate against Muslims and Christians in India.
Right.
So it is it's a network of organizations. They have schools, they have colleges, they have informal education centers, they have publishing houses, and they are functioning for, and they work in tribal areas. So they have a very well-knit network of these organizations, and they work in close collaboration with each other. So they have a student wing, they have a youth wing, they have wing of journalists, they have wing of teachers, they have primary schools. And so this is how they work. Right. So even when they were not in power, they kept working. And that is how they have been able to, I would say, raise fascists.
Yeah.
And their number is in lakhs. So you have lakhs of fascists in India working as normal human beings, our colleagues.
So here's where our analysis slightly differed, because I did not understand the Indian situation as well as I maybe should have. Because when we were talking about how to approach or begin to fight against fascism globally, I kind of said something like, you know, look, the real problem is, you know, leftists are the only people who want to fight fascism, and liberals hate leftists as much as they hate fascists. And the, you know, liberals are always willing to allow fascists to come in if the alternative is, or right wingers to come in if the alternative is the left. And I cited, you know, the way they destroyed Corbyn in the UK, or the way they destroyed Sanders in the US to make way for Trump or Boris Johnson, whatever, the way they destroyed the Workers' Party in Brazil to make way for Bolsonaro. But you mentioned that there's what we would call here like some brown-red alliances that worked, where the left was so willing to try to exclude the liberals that they effectively tactically allied with the right, and that the result was that the left was probably in some ways rightly wiped out electorally, and for example in the Bengal election. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
So I think it was a faulty and flawed understanding of politics of West Bengal, that the left, especially the Communist Party of India, Marxist entertained. So the understanding was that if the man is to remove Trinamool Congress, which you can call a liberal political party, which is not an anti-minority political party, it's not anti-majority. It's Hindu. It's a Hindu-led party, you must say. But it's a liberal political party. But the left thought that since Trinamool Congress had replaced left in West Bengal, the primary duty and primary task of the left was to remove Trinamool Congress from the power. And that is why they gave this slogan in Bangla that Ebar Ram, Abar Bam. So this time, let them come this time. Next time, it would be us.
Which is like that was a German slogan of the left as well, after Hitler, us. So also didn't work out so well for them.
So that was the slogan that the left gave. And
Let's just make a historical note for listeners. So West Bengal, relatively small state, ruled by the Communist Party, like a left front led by the Communist Party Marxists of India for about 30 something years, right? And then 34 years, and then basically lost all their seats to a pretty much a local party, right? Trinamool doesn't really exist outside of Bengal, does it?
No.
Yeah. So a local party with a very charismatic leader, Mamata Banerjee. And this last election was contested mainly basically between Trinamool and the BJP, and Trinamool just won. So
yes, that. And it swept the polls.
Swept the polls, yeah.
It served the polls, I would say.
Left is wiped out. But the left in Kerala also managed to wipe out the BJP, but then in Assam, the BJP won. So how do you analyze this landscape in terms of what the opposition did, where it worked, where it didn't work, what they should be doing, that kind of thing?
I think India is a subcontinental state, and Kerala is very different from Bengal.
Yeah.
And Kerala CPM is also very different from Bengal CPM.
Yeah.
We must understand that. Kerala CPM, I would say, in many ways, is very pragmatic. It continues to be CPM, but it's pragmatic. And that's why it managed to save power and come back to power in a very respectable manner.
Right.
But Kerala is different. Tamil Nadu is different.
Yeah.
And they are not influenced by what I call Hindi nationalism. And they look at anything which is coming from northern part of India with suspicion. And the whole lexicon of the Bharatiya Janata Party and its cultural repertoire is drawn from North India.
Right.
So the problem with Bharatiya Janata Party is that it was trying to export Hindi nationalism to Kerala and Tamil Nadu.
Yeah.
And it created revulsion in the population of Tamil Nadu and Kerala. We can talk about it in detail, but we don't have time.
But that's not going to work in the Hindi parts of India, I guess.
Yes. So what they were trying to do was to repeat what they had done in Hindi and establish this Hindi nationalism in these parts of India. So it was rejected by the people of Tamil Nadu. And if you look at the Twitter handle of the new chief minister of Tamil Nadu, Stalin. So he proudly declares that he belongs to the Dravid stock.
So this proud declaration, in a very pronounced way,
that he is different, this assertion, it's very important to understand what is happening there, because they are telling that you are different, you are trying to hegemonize us, but we won't allow you to do it. But in Assam, it worked very differently, because in Assam, there were already fault lines. Right. This suspicion against Bengali-speaking people, especially Bengali-speaking Muslims, which are seen as intruders, Bangladeshis. So the Assamese-speaking people have traditionally entertained hatred or suspicion towards these people who are Bengali-speaking Hindus and Muslims. What the BJP did, it sharpened the anti-Muslim thing and it dulled the anti-Hindu thing. Mm. So the Assamese thing turned into basically anti-Muslim, anti-Bengali Muslim thing. And it worked. It worked very well. Assam again is not a very, it's again a complex territory. You have Upper Assam and you have Lower Assam and they are different. For example, if you go to the areas of Silchar, they are very different from areas of Guwahati or other areas of Assam. But the BJP, what the BJP did, it negotiated with small tribal groups, small ethnic groups, and promised them their share of the cake, their share of power. So it did negotiation with them, won them over to its side, and sharpened the anti-Bengali Muslim feeling in the Assamese people, and it worked. Wow. So Assam went to BJP, but in Bengal the battle was very fierce, very direct, and in Bengal you have more than 30% Muslims. So it was a battle like do or die in Bengal for Muslims. And many of the electorate who were traditionally followers of the left, they could see that the left won't be able to resist the Bharatiya Janata Party. So they moved to Trinamool Congress. And that is how Trinamool Congress secured more than 48% of the popular votes, the highest it has got in its entire career, political career. So West Bengal is very different. Assam is very different. Kerala and Tamil Nadu are very different. But I'm afraid BJP through RSS is working relentlessly and is looking at micro factors where it would drive a wedge, strike some kind of a compromise with the local ethnic group, and then start replicating itself. It's like coronavirus, because
I was thinking it's like the East India Company. Yeah,
East India. It finds a host. So if it gets a host, it starts multiplying itself.
Yeah,
that is how it works.
So last question, then. I don't want to keep you. I know it's getting late there, last question is this, so do you think this is, I guess, in the best case scenario where things are headed, you know, like a more federalized kind of system where things go on differently in the states, and the BJP continues to have a very strong power, you know, at the grassroots and at the center, especially in the so-called Hindi belt? Or do you think there is a more optimistic scenario for how right-wing politics could be kind of rolled back? What kind of strategy do you imagine could work in India?
As things stand today, I I don't have a very clear picture of how things would unfold in near future, because we are going to have our next general elections in 2024.
Yeah.
And it's 3 years from
That's
now.
A long
three
time.
Years, it's a long time. Many things can happen. The Bharatiya Janata Party government can do many things to again arouse nationalist feelings across India. So many things can happen. But as you said, that our hope lies in the federal character of India getting more and more pronounced.
Right.
So the regional forces like Dravida Munnetra Kazhagam in Tamil Nadu, I would characterize CPM of Kerala as the regional party with strong Malayalam characteristics.
Yeah.
So to assert these differences, I think, would save India.
Right.
Because the threat is largely, I teach Hindi. But I would say that the threat comes from Hindi nationalism. So what BJP does, BJP draws its strength from Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, and the strength that it gets from these states, on the basis of that, it wants to colonize the rest of India, that is non-Hindi speaking areas, Odisha or Andhra Pradesh or Telangana or other areas. But I would like to again warn myself and other friends that there is always this threat of the pan-Indian Hindu thing.
Yeah.
Because even if you go to Tamil Nadu, even if you go to Kerala, even if you go to Assam, you can find this Hindu thing.
Yeah.
And the BJP can very well ride on it.
Yeah.
And like a parasite, and work through this default Hindu setting. So, and also,
the Hindu setting is also like an anti-Islam setting, right? Like an anti-Muslim setting. Such a powerful.
Because how do you describe a Hindu?
Yeah.
A Hindu or a political Hindu is one who hates Muslims.
That's it. Yeah.
Muslims and Christians with great suspicion.
Yeah.
And who thinks that their interests are very different and they are antagonistic to each other. So that is how a political Hindu defines himself. I would say himself, also herself. So this is my fear. But everything would depend on how political parties work, how the civil society functions, and how we take this challenge, how seriously we take this challenge.
Wow. All right. Thank you so much, Apurvanand. That was a lot to think about. Maybe we'll talk again, you know, in a couple months or something. Hopefully when COVID is a little bit better.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you.
Thanks.